Today's episode is sponsored by Frangipani, one of the UK's most iconic independent shirt brands. Frangipani started in 2010 has grown into a proper cult label, proudly British but worn all over the world. Everything they do is about colour, character and having a good time. They're best known for their limited edition printed shirts, small batch and never mass produced, and they've been worn by an incredible mix of people. We're talking legends like Mick Jagger, Roger Taylor, Ray Winston, Ian Wright, James Blunt, and dance music royalty Carl Cox and Fatboy Slim, to name but a few. So these are shirts for people who like a bit of personality in what they wear, for ideal for festivals, gigs, holidays, weddings abroad, or just a great night out. And they're offering Stage Left podcast listeners an exclusive deal for 25% off everything on their website, even things that are listed in their January sales. So use the code Stage Left, so capital letters, Stage Left, all one word, for 25% off at checkout. And just head to www.frangipani-style.com and use the code Stage Left for 25% off. So that's www.frangipani, which is frangipani-style.com, because life's too short to be ordinary. So hey everyone, it's Chris from the Stage Left podcast. I hope we are doing well. Welcome to our episode with Woody from Bastille. This was recorded just a few days afterwards. What a privilege, actually. We recorded this just a few days after Bastille had sold out the O2 Arena in the UK, as well as a string of sold out dates at arena venues across England, Scotland and Wales. A great guy. Full transparency. Woody's been on the podcast before, but we talk about stuff that we haven't talked about in the past. And actually, in case anybody's listening to this going, oh, these guys feel a little bit familiar, we are actually close friends now. We go on family holidays and stuff like that. But don't let that stop you listening to this episode thinking, hang on, is Chris giving him all the right questions and asking all the difficult stuff? Because, of course, I still did that. Really interesting insight as to what it's like to be a day-to-day musician working in an arena-level band. Also now runs his own label and... Oh my word, so interesting the way he breaks down like deal structures, using me as an example as well. And this was recorded in front of a live audience of music students as well, so you get to hear some of their questions too. So really fun experience. We've got some really exciting episodes coming up, including Russ Pritchard of Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds, done in a similar setting, and a couple other ones that we're not allowed to announce yet. But welcome back to our listeners who are back with us after a little bit of a break. Lots of exciting things happening this year that I can't quite say, but that's part of the reason why we've taken some time out to be able to arrange them. So yes, some exciting things to come, which you're going to hear about very soon. Definitely follow us on Instagram and X and Facebook, but particularly Instagram and TikTok, actually, because we're putting loads of great content on there at the moment about the episodes, previous episodes, things that are coming up. We've been supported on TikTok by Instagram by Alex Fordham, who does the social medias for Elbow, for Manic Street Preachers, for Cooler Shaker as well. So that's the person who's now doing a lot of our social media videos, so you might enjoy some of the content on there as well, which is often a lot of behind the scenes stuff and gigs we go to. So do check us out there. So we hope you enjoy the episode. This is Woody from Bastille.
Please give it up from Bastille. Give it up for Woody. Thank you.
Did Steve really say that?
Yeah.
Hello.
Yes.
Flattering, right?
I have a pint.
Yeah. Good stuff. So you've just come off a tour. What's it like 3 days after playing a tour to so many great venues and the reality?
It's a bit of a difference going from being looked after, tour manager, catering, all that sort of stuff, to here are your children. Yeah, it's a bit of an adjustment. So I guess I'm very lucky now that I've been doing this for a fair old while. I know some people, especially younger artists, when they're touring, when they come back, often come up against problems where you sort of miss that buzz. I mean, like, you sort of get acclimatized to like around 9 o'clock, your body starts to wake up, you're like, oh, because it's normally gig time. People miss that buzz of touring and everything, so that's how people get a bit bored. It's kind of midday, they're like, pub? Yeah, and that's how like drug problems, alcohol problems can creep in, because everyone's just trying to replace that buzz of being on tour. I'm very fortunate that I've been with my missus, who you know her, since like day dot of the band, so I've always come back to like a sense of normality, when you come off tour as well. But also, yeah, I'm very bad at doing nothing, so I'm busy doing stuff all the time anyway when I'm off tour.
And Woody's an amazing producer and songwriter in his own right, which we're going to touch upon in a little while. And I think that's probably where you go to a certain degree when you're off tour. It was really interesting to get the insight, having been at the sound check to an arena show the other day. What are the main aims of that sound check for you personally, and how does that differ to others in the band?
So, I don't know how many of you play on in-ears when you gig, all that sort of stuff, but you'd imagine every night sounds identical. It does not. It depends on the room. The Hydro in Glasgow is possibly the worst sounding room in the UK. You hit a snare drum once, you hear it five more times, it's firing around the room, it's just chaos. So the importance of those sound checks is to just try and get your ears dialed in, like take some bits out of the mix just to sort of clear it up. The worst one we ever had was Rock in Rio in Lisbon, which I know is not in Rio, but like same festival. And it was in this massive natural sort of bowl. And again, hit the snare once, I heard it 20 times. Everyone was just like cranking their packs, trying to get everything taken out of their ears. It was like the worst sounding space ever. Whereas everyone out front's having fun and it seems all right. But yeah, on stage, we're all losing our heads. So yeah, a lot of it is just kind of making sure everything's working. And often, like even when we started the tour, some arrangements hadn't been finished yet. And we've got a brand new song, in fact, out today, Save My Soul, go and get it. We were sort of tweaking bits of that, tweaking the mix for live and settings and just general technical nonsense.
And what's the balance for you personally like between feeling rehearsed and over-rehearsed? Where do you need to sit in those two places? And is that different to the rest of the band?
We don't rehearse enough to ever over-rehearse. Muscle memory is hell of a thing. So before this tour we just did, I hadn't been out with the band for like 2 years. It's amazing how quickly all the sort of old sort of habits, like in a good way, came back. Even like a couple run-throughs in rehearsal, like hadn't played like a song called Laura Palmer for 2 years, and it's like even the things like live muscle memory kicked in. I found myself standing up during one of the middle eights and clapping. I was like, oh yeah, I forgot I used to do that. But yeah, I would say to any band or any musician, if you can, like you can't practice enough, but also playing live is worth way more than any time like in the rehearsal space. So our first time we ever did live TV was live on Sky, Isle of Wight Festival, main stage in 2013. And by this point, we'd played all the songs like 1,000 times. We've been around multiple tours, which was good. So we were like well-drilled. Muscle memory is a big thing here. We learned that day, again, on in-ear monitors, all on wireless packs. If the stage manager accidentally gives the band on after you the exact same frequencies you're using at the time, and they turn their gear on, it cancels everything out.
Oh.
So we were mid-song, live on Sky, and go instantly deaf. And my world just fell out from underneath me. Almost needed new trousers.
Wow.
We were deaf for about 8 seconds, which felt like 8 years. But Ben, our monitor engineer, kind of clocked what it was straight away, did a sort of like a running Superman dive and just like yanked all their cables out, and it came back on. So we sort of drifted a tiny bit, but again, muscle memory, we didn't panic and just the hands kept going, the fingers went to where they should be, and no one up front really noticed, other than all our complexions went incredibly pale.
Yeah, wow.
Instantly.
So when it comes to rehearsals, so you know we've got lots of great musicians in the room. What is that balance for you personally that you feel completely relaxed to go on stage in regards to knowing exactly what you're doing? Because for context, I interviewed someone called Tony Allen, who you know is a legendary drummer, and he's no longer with us. And he kind of famously said this thing that he didn't want to rehearse so much because he kind of felt like he knew his parts and he's a bit of a jazz player, versus other members of a band called The Good, The Bad and The Queen, who some of you will know, members of Gorillaz in that band, and Damon Albarn, were like, no, we want to rehearse a lot. So Damon Albarn wants to rehearse and rehearse and rehearse, so everything's kind of metronomic and we know exactly what we're doing. So where does it sit with you? How do you feel relaxed? Is it that you still have a little bit of uncertainty, or do you want everything, every crease ironed out?
I mean, we're playing pop music. Like, it's not speed metal. It's not like over the top, like odd time jazz where it's really tricky arrangements. It's generally verse, pre, chorus, middle eight. So structure, it's more just kind of knowing the stops and stuff. I mean, I've got a method which Pat Garvey, I'm sure some of you get taught by Pat, showed me. The sort of dots and dashes method, which if he hasn't shown you yet, go and ask him. It's like, changed my life in terms of like learning songs. Yeah, it's just I think he learned it from like a drummer from Broadway, I think, or something like that. Basically, if you have to learn songs quickly, It's this method of dots and dashes where you can sketch out the whole structure of a song in like one listen, and then add notes to that on the second listen, and it's done. So wow. For me, I mean, I'm quite a practical person in terms of like learning things and memorizing stuff. Just so even if I'm not checking the chart, the act of making the chart has sort of like put the map in my head. If that makes sense.
Wow.
So as long as I know when I'm stopping, then generally speaking, I'm kind of happy with that.
Great.
But yeah, I'm not the sort of person that's like every fill must be exactly the same every night. There's a little bit of leeway. But then someone like Tony, who's like such a virtuoso, like creative player, I imagine he wants it to be different every night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly, because that's the jazz element as well, isn't it? So I don't know if anyone saw Bastille on this tour or realised this, but you actually had a percussionist on stage, so Gabby King, who has done, her name's up there actually. You can see Gabby King up there. So tell us about how you divvied up the part. So just for your context, Woody was playing drums, you also had a kind of percussion setup, but actually for one of the songs you switched over as well. So talk us through how you worked with Gabby to identify exactly what to play and not to play and who's playing when.
So Gabby obviously came in much later. So it's not as if, say, like we all started a band together and we're trying to figure out parts in the studio. There was like pre-existing songs to like sort of dissect. Mm-hmm. She's incredible, like old mate of mine, ours, known her for years. And also plays with the 75s. I'm sure you've heard of them. So yeah, she's really good anyway. It's a really good vibe. And like she, because she's quite established and experienced, she wasn't afraid of sort of speaking her mind in rehearsals. Cause
really?
Because people often be like, I'll do whatever you want. And she'd be like, this isn't working for me. This feels weird here. She would actually kind of question stuff, which is good. Like you want that.
Nice.
And then, so historically we've had, I mean, this is no secret. Like we have tracks live because there's often been five of us on stage, as well as like big sort of like soaring string sections and that sort of thing. And obviously there's no orchestra on stage because we'd be bankrupt. So yeah, with the track stuff, like any extra like percussion bits, like our ethos was always, we use up every available limb and digit that can make a noise. Once that's done, then it can go on track if it's missing. So we sort of took a ton of stuff off track. In fact, there's like way more parts actually on the last tour that are pretty missing, but because we had Gabby, and also AK Patterson as well, who's this amazing singer, guitarist, violin player, just
does everything,
virtuosic,
right? Great, yeah,
genius. They sort of covered a lot of bases. So I think it actually sounded bigger having less. That makes sense. It just kind of gave everything more room to breathe. We just kind of ran the songs. And it was like, does it feel fun? That was the real thing.
And technically, were you asking her to play certain parts in particular elements of the songs, or did you just say, yeah, okay.
She's having to like change shakers in certain songs and play like left, two and four on different surfaces and switch to toms. And
so did you sit down and work out those parts, or was it a case that you gave her the freedom to have a go at that and then edit it from there? Or
yeah, she came in with like a bunch of ideas.
Great.
Something like, yes, that's cool. Not that so much.
Nice.
There's a bit of push and pull. And then, yeah, her switching places with me, sorry, that was for a song called No Bad Days, which was alternated. We didn't do it every night. That was like, there was a few songs on the tour where it kind of came in and out the set list. And again, she's like an absolute monster drummer as well. I thought it'd be kind of fun just to get her playing. And it transpired afterwards, she played the O2 a few times with the 75s and never actually played drums.
That's right.
So when the set list chat was happening, she was basically like elbow in the ribs. It's like, we're doing that one tonight. Like, okay, fine.
Nice.
So, yeah,
so she got to play drums at the O2, which is class. I'd like one word from you for each of these stages. So given that you've toured and played these huge gigs, when you are in the last few days running up to this current tour that you've just done of arenas, what's one word that you feel summarises your emotions before? And what's one word that summarises during? And one word that summarises your emotions after?
It's more, what's a word that summarizes like trying to pull? It'll be all right in the night.
Okay, right. Interesting.
There was so many, like, not so much the playing part of it, but like production. Like, we've got all the video screens and the content, and we brought in lasers and all manner of stuff. Yeah. And we had like an idea of how the arc of the show was going to go. I'm sorry, I realize this is not a one-word answer.
It's fine.
But we were ironing that out even into like the second night of the tour.
Right.
Bits were getting changed and redone.
And is that out of design, because you wanted to have that ambiguity there? Because I think this is really interesting for all the musicians in the room. Is that out of design, or was it a case that you literally didn't quite get through what you needed to in the rehearsal booked time?
It's what I imagine. It's like being a rocket scientist, where it's right. Like, On paper, it looks fine.
Right.
But until it goes up in the sky, you don't actually know if it's going to explode or it's going to fly or not.
Yeah.
So there's a few ideas we had. Maybe, like, it wasn't like if it was going to like crash or burn, but more that edge needs smoothing off a little bit, or this thing doesn't quite work, or that could be a bit more concise there.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was the mindset. So yeah, but by the time we hit production rehearsals, we're not thinking about the actual playing. It's like, how does the show look? Even things like who's going to go where for what bits, because like, we're trying to have little chapters, because the tour was called From All Sides, and it was basically trying to cover all parts of our career to date. So we've done like MTV Unplugged, we've done big electro stuff, we've done rock stuff, we've done small acoustic stuff, we've done big pop stuff. So it's just trying to visually also mark those things as well, not just like in terms of like audio.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, have not tell a story as such, but you know, it'd be like, oh, this is this section, this feels small here.
So I was going to come on to actually this in a second, but let's, which is around set lists and deciding set lists. But what about your emotion during? If you, is one word that summarizes your emotion during, is it euphoria or is it?
It's just fun.
Chaos, fun. Okay, great. And after?
More fun.
Depends how long after the show, right?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Good stuff. Okay, so how do you decide set lists? Because you've got such a body of work and there's songs that people want to hear, there's songs that you want to play in a particular way. How do you, what's the process to deciding set lists?
Dartboard. No, we build it with two kinds of people in mind. One is like your sort of casual punter who might have heard Pompeii or whatever, or Happier. And then to like the more sort of hardcore like fan who's like, he like knows all the deep cuts. I mean, we're so privileged. There's a ton of fans who came to like every show, like on the barrier every night, same faces, which is incredible. So have them in mind. We don't want to do the same set every night for us and for them. We sort of think of it like sort of like tent poles, if you will. So like certain songs that are going to have to go in there,
yeah,
because people will kick off if we didn't do it. And then it's like what would fit in and around that. But for instance, like a song of ours called Floors, which is like one of our first singles, but it's like a big electro synth pop thing. We completely redid it for like the more unplugged section, so it's a lot more stripped back. And so yeah, basically it was kind of, these are the songs we want to have in this giant pool. Then we started knocking them into different sort of groups. Like, this is like big upbeat pop, this is the rocky bit, this could go in unplugged, this can go in XYZ. So every there was like, say, like six different pools of songs that had different jobs to do, and it's like, right, this fits more in that world. And then from there we had four or five like slots basically in the set where we were trying to alternate it every night. So I think we achieved it. We never played the same set list twice.
Wow, nice.
Don't quote me on that, but that was the intention.
Be checking Setlist FM to see if that's the case. So this is really relevant to all the musicians in the room, I think. You had quite a broad range of support acts.
Yep.
Tell us how they are chosen and how do people get on your radar to be eventually a support act?
That was largely led by me, much to the dismay of our roadies, because they would love to have the same support band every night, because they can just have all the settings preset, load it up and go. So they put in a hell of a shift for us, so I'm very grateful for that. But there's a bunch of acts who are either newly signed or unsigned, that we've, well, either I've written with, or Will's written with, or Dan's written with from the band, because the tour, again, very grateful, like sold really well. So it wasn't like we were relying on support acts to help push tickets. Mm. At that point, it's like, well, we can now offer a platform to like upcoming acts. So the same time, who are Aussie brothers but based in Brighton, I'm sure some of you guys know them. Top lads, smashed it. They came and did the first night of the tour. And just, yeah, anyone that we sort of like and enjoy. If it's a case of like, oh, you need to sell some tickets, then it's like, okay, that's a discussion with your agent. Or often it's like the label pull a favor, like we've just signed so and so. Can we use this as a sort of way to, you know, spotlight them as well?
So you weren't under any pressure from your label to pick similar acts from your label at all. So you had complete creative control.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. And did you have anything in the back of your mind, which was somewhere like the O2? I'm sure many people have been there. It holds 15,000, something like that.
18 and a half,
there you go. So in your head, were you thinking, how do we ensure these people are ready for this stage? Because I guess, I might be wrong, but that must have been a bit of a step up for quite a number of the artists.
So the O2 was the one exception where, so we had like a main support every night, but that was cut in two. So it was Sophia Kamara for part of it and Bradley Simpson for the other half. Mm-hmm. For the final night, we had both of them as the openers. But the other ones, it was more than, so same time, for instance, I mentioned like they basically conquered Brighton already. So there's no point in them playing Brighton.
Yeah.
So dragged them all the way down to my hometown in Plymouth.
Nice.
They had a good night. Yeah, I mean, sort of. I mean, it's just kind of, we like, I've seen all these acts play that I vouch for. Like, I trust them to do a job, and it's just same job on a slightly bigger scale.
Yeah, nice. So there's a song by Bastille. Some of you would definitely have known it. It's called Happier. It's had over a billion streams on Spotify, right? And always since, and you've never said this to me, so it's just from the outside, that there's a bit of a love-hate relationship with that, how that song is, certainly from things that Dan has said on stage, like the MTV Unplugged show. You changed the version, and you did quite a rocky version of it, right? So tell us about, and it was really, it was great. Tell us about how you kind of deconstructed that in rehearsals and created the version that you did.
We did that before, we did a little gig for Dork magazine in the summer at the 100 Club.
That's right, yeah.
Around their 100th issue. We've done a few versions of that over the years. It's gone very electronic and not so much. And it was like, well, it'd be kind of fun just to do it complete. I mean, we're always changing things up. It'd be fun to do it on its head. So it was just kind of approach it as like, there's five of us in the room. These are the instruments. How can we achieve the similar like ups and downs and light and shade of what we have? I sort of suggested we do a kind of a shoegazy rock thing just as a vibe. And everyone seemed into it. And the more we kind of went through it and played around with it, added bits, took bits away, it just sort of gradually came together.
It's great. It's great. Thank you. And something really wholesome happened on the tour, which is your dad, who has been a musician his whole life, never quite got to the level that Woody's at. You invited him on stage to play on Pompeii, which is pretty extraordinary. So he's playing to an arena. How did he react when you asked him, and how did that play out?
Right. I thought this was going to be some mad emotional thing. He was icy cold. He
really?
Was so chill. So to context, so he's been gigging since the 70s. He's the reason I'm in music. He's played every possible pub, venue, bar in Plymouth ever, except the Pavilions, which is where we played. So he's now completed Plymouth.
Nice.
Which is great. But yeah, I was kind of like stood like side of stage next to him, because it was like after the
encore. When did you ask him?
The night before.
Right, okay.
Because I was kind of judging, is it going to be the right time? And he was up for it. I just...
And you didn't rehearse with it? You didn't get a chance to do it at sound check, right?
No. Nah.
Right, nice.
But again, chatting to him side of stage, I was like, you feeling good? You up for this? He's like, yeah, I'm fine.
Nice.
Just four chords, isn't it? I was like,
yeah, nice.
All right, okay. But then text me about 3 days later, it's like, I think it's just sunk in what we did.
Wow.
Like, okay, right, there we go.
So his setup, did he use his own guitar, or did he use one of the
bands? Borrowed
guitar.
Alex's, yeah.
And he's on backing vocals as well?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, beautiful. And so I saw him on Sunday, and we had a chat about it, and he was just like, he loved it. So I think he was playing it cool when he said, you know, the fact that you said he was kind of icy cold, it meant a lot to him, man. I think it's about as wholesome as you can get.
I've wanted to do that for years as well. So
yeah.
I did it.
And you got a great photo of you walking off stage, kind of arm in arm in front of like a huge crowd. It was really beautiful. What an experience for him and for you. So the new song that you mentioned today, it's out. I didn't realize it's out today. So Save Our Soul, right? So when was that? Did you write that before the tour, I'm guessing? And was that deliberate as a kind of thing, or did it come out of the rehearsals? Yeah. How did that come about?
It was so we started doing bits together. I'm not going to commit to saying we started writing an album yet, and that's not happened yet. But bits and bobs have been knocked around, and Dan came into rehearsal. He's like, I've got an idea for a song that's pretty much there. Start playing around with it, and then as we get into rehearsals, he's like, I think we should play it on tour. I'm like, next year, right? He's like, nope.
Wow.
This one in like 10 days. You're like, fuck.
It's a good challenge.
It was, yeah. So I do, well, me and Kyle, we do like a ton of the programming for live, like with all the drum stuff and all the synths for Kyle. So yeah, we pulled two or three like all-nighters to kind of make it happen. But we did it in the end, and I'm like, I'm really pleased with it. But it was never like a, we need a new song for this tour. It was just, it came around at the right time and it felt right. And I mean, Dan's quite good at writing tunes for big rooms.
Yeah.
It seems to go down well.
So let's talk about learning the drums. So you were given lessons by an absolute kind of godfather of drum tutoring, which is a guy called Bob Armstrong. So some of you may have heard that name, some of you won't have done. Pat Garvey used to get drum lessons from Bob Armstrong. He actually grew up, he's actually from where I grew up, and his name is just kind of royalty. Sadly, he passed away a few years ago. So you used to travel quite a long way to get lessons in Hornchurch and Essex from him. Tell us about, what were the specific things that he taught you that you put into practice today?
Oh God, so when you zoom out and see what I've learned from him since, it makes sense. At the time, I thought it was a joke.
Really?
So for the first 5 months I was going to see him, I'm just playing quarter notes on the ride at 50 BPM.
Mm.
But he was all about, the arm action and all like all the like all the kind of mechanics and the grip. And I was like, this guy's the best drum teacher in the country. I'm just doing this. And I was like, it was a joke. But then as he starts add like sort of like bolting bits onto that, then it all makes sense. So like without that kind of core thing being there, the rest of it wouldn't work. So yeah, he built out my technique, like basically completely rebuilt it from the ground up, which I'm so grateful for now, because like, touch wood, I've never had a playing injury ever. I can play 2 hours a night in like zero pain. I don't need to get worked on. I know some mates in other bands who had like tennis elbow and surgery and had to miss tours and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, so Bob's big thing for me is like giving me durability, I suppose.
Wow.
So being able to play like efficiently and quite loud, but without taking a toll like on your body.
It's worth looking into him if you're a drummer in the room. If you aren't aware of him, there's a lot of great drums in the UK. So the drummer of Elbow and two members of Oasis previously, drummers got lessons from Bob and
Andy Gangadine as well.
Yeah, there's so many of them. Did he ever talk to you about performance, or was it literally just technical elements?
Musicality and technical. Never talked about like being on the stage or anything.
Right. Okay.
But I remember because I saw him for 4 years from being literally in crap wedding bands and just scraping a living to then the band gets signed and gradually goes on. And eventually I was like, I didn't actually finish with him, which is a bit of a frustration, but I was like, Bob, I'm really sorry. Like, I've got to go on tour the next 6 months. So I had to miss lessons. He's like, good. That's the whole point you came to see me.
Amazing.
No bugger off.
I was like, yeah. All right. And is it true that sometimes he would leave you and he'd go and have a cigarette while you just continue in and then you
He must have done about 80 fags a day.
Really?
Easy.
Wow. Right.
Yeah, he'd come in, set you on your way, go outside, have a tab.
Right.
Come back in, check on you. That's all right. Change that. Go outside, have a tab.
Wow.
But it worked. Also, like having that time, because also I think some teachers could be like over attentive. Like if it's almost just sat over your shoulder for an hour, just staring, it can get a bit much.
Mm.
Actually giving you time to sort of sit with it for a minute, maybe lose the plot for 5 minutes,
yeah,
refocus and then try again.
And were you, I'm guessing he gave you stuff to do in between sessions to work on.
Oh God, yeah. I've got like a folder at home. This really? Still. Yeah.
Right, so that would have gone a long way towards that. Did you ever turn up to a session having not done the lesson?
I wouldn't have dared.
No, right.
No.
Yeah.
But when I saw him, I can play jazz now. I could not play jazz then. I was horrific. He does this like assessment with you where, so you sit down, like play this, play that, blah, 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 makes notes. After 2.5 years of seeing him, we sort of moved off the jazz stuff onto the more technical, like marching, like technical snare drum stuff. He's like, oh, yeah, boy, do you want to see my notes from your first thing? Like, yeah, sure. Just goes, Chris Wood, jazz, no. That's all I got.
Wow, what feedback.
Yeah, right. Just no.
Wow. And so some of you in the room would have obviously worked with Pat Garvey, and you've done a lot of... Have you had lessons in the past with Pat Garvey? You worked with him in certain
situations. Yeah, so like I would recommend anyone... No matter what level you get to, just to have an extra set of eyes on you every now and then always helps. Like Pat studied with Bob, knows all the things that we've gone through, and there's like little weird habits will creep in without you even realizing. He's like, stop doing that, like a little weird twist of the wrist or something before you do something. Yeah, I see Pat occasionally still. It's just good to kind of keep it all tuned up.
And Gabby, who's up there, she occasionally has lessons with Pat as well. So despite playing, you know, Madison Square Garden and all these huge venues, it's important that you've always got someone to coach you through it and support you through it. So that's really cool. Let's talk about some of the wider elements in the music industry in regards to building a fan base. I mean, you've got such loyal fans. And this is going to be a two-pronged question, which I try and avoid doing sometimes. But you've got a very loyal fan base. And one example of that is, I don't know if I've ever told you this actually, so we were leaving, when you played the Brighton Centre on the last tour, I'd very luckily been in and out the back of the building like a number of times throughout the day, and then we were having drinks after the show, and the last people to leave were me, you and Dan, right, Dan's a singer, and as we went out the back, I'd walked in and out of this place all day, and I was like, right, see you later, opened the doors, and I stood next to Dan, right, and it was like a VR headset of what it's like to be like a really huge star, because there was three rows of screaming fans who were still there at 2 a.m. in the morning, and it was such a mind-blowing experience to see, wow, that, you know, how that must impact you. So it's a two kind of pronged question, which is, one, how do you go about building a fan base? What do you think really works and doesn't work? And secondly, like, how does that impact you as a human walking through a door and those people are screaming towards you? Like, is that healthy or unhealthy? Or
I'm the drummer, no one's screaming at
they
me.
They do, fine. They did. I've seen it happen, man. That's
So we're really fortunate in that, yeah, we've got some very loyal fans, also some quite respectful ones. Cause I remember we did the signing tent at Reading a couple of years ago. And this girl came up to get something signed. How's it going? It's like, do you live in Brighton? I was like, yeah. It's like, yeah, I thought that was you, but I saw your two-year-old go mental and you were trying to sort them out. So I was like, I'll leave you alone. It's like, oh, thank you so much.
Like, not the time.
Not a time for a selfie, no.
Yeah.
I would say, I got asked this the other week. So I also run, we'll get onto this for sure. I run a record label now as well. I'm working with like newer artists that are coming through and sort of coming up against this conundrum of like, how do you develop a fan base now? So like, when we came up, we were on this thing called MySpace, if you remember that, for the dawn of time. And we sort of built it up on there, and then we were just doing it old school, gigging, sort of word got around, the shows got busier, we gradually built it that way. There's an artist that I work with at the minute called BT. She's amazing. She's got like, not massive, but like a really ultra loyal fan base. She's done like a WhatsApp group now where I would say it's like kind of similar to us in a way. It's like all about community. People end up sort of making friends at the gigs. It's kind of like football. Like, wow, sometimes a match gets in the way of hanging out with your mates.
Yeah, wow.
Or can ruin your weekend. Yeah. But yeah, people now, like I know people who have like become couples and got married from meeting at our gigs. And yeah, like there's a whole community. I think that's how you get the fan base. And also we did two mixtapes for free, which were highly illegal. We sampled everything, didn't get any clearance, just put it on the internet and had some... We learned two new words, which were cease and desist.
Right, okay.
That got pulled down.
Yeah.
But by giving away stuff for free, when it was like, oh, by the way, we've got an album, people are more willing to kind of come with you and like say, like buy a t-shirt or buy a CD as was then. So it's like, if you can offer value and like a sense of like I hate the expression like building a world because it's so pretentious, but like building like a vibe or, you know, like a club almost.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to be a part of this, like this community.
What specific things you think, because you're right, you do have that sense of community amongst your fans. How have you either directly or indirectly or consciously or subconsciously cultivated that?
Just by not being assholes, hopefully.
Yeah, it's one true. Of the ones. But still really, like, they're kind of known as being like the nice people on tour. Like, you often like share equipment and share certain things and are always kind of very open in that way. And so I've never heard any other band ever say, have a bad word to say about Bastille. So that probably helps, and to a certain degree.
And
with your fans as well, you know, that helps as well.
But yeah, I think just being genuine as well. Yeah. I always say the worst feedback you can get for your music, anything you do, is like indifference. It's a shoulder shrug. Like, I'd love someone to hate it because it means someone else is probably going to love it.
Yeah, nice.
It's just that like, indifference is like, ugh. So we've always sort of just been quite sort of pig-headed, I guess, in terms of like, we're going to go and do this. Like the last album was like a retro-futuristic album, like kind of Blade Runner-y,
yeah,
kind of Tron-esque. We had like our own fake like Apple sort of style corporation we made up for the tour, and like a VR headset experience on stage kind of thing, which is a bit over the top, but
it was amazing to see it though.
But yeah, just having like a kind of concept of what you want it to be. But then also, that's not for every band. Like someone like me, just looking on the wall now, like Idols, it's all about like just like the energy and just trying to be good people and that sort of thing, and people buy into that. So it's just everyone finds their tribe, I guess, or like finds their sort of calling in like different areas.
So if there's one thing you're telling the people in this room right now to do in regards to building a fan base, what is it?
Just think of it as a community.
Yeah.
I think that's what I've seen. Also seeing in like retrospect, like I'm not saying like I knew this all along and that's how we did it. It's like, it's now like in hindsight, I'm like, oh, actually that's what it became. I see people doing it now more proactively from the start. Just given what is your community? What is your tribe? Like, how can you make people want to join that?
Now, you just mentioned about running your own label. How do record deals work today? Summarize how it was in the past compared to how it is today and the differences.
Legalized loan sharking.
Right, wow.
Is what I would call it.
Wow.
So if anyone's not had it explained to them before, I will do it again here for everyone listening. So imagine Chris here is an up-and-coming songwriter. I want to sign his album. £100,000 advance for you, sir.
Thanks.
On your classic 80-20 split record deal, which should be 80% goes to me, 20% goes to Chris. I'll give you 100 grand. You're thinking, Christmas. Off we go. You go touring, working really hard. And then your song streams really well. You've generated 100 grand. You're like, fantastic. The loan's paid off. It's like, no. Because 80% of that is mine. 20% of it is yours. which means ultimately you have to generate £500,000 to pay off a £100,000 loan, which is, yeah, like most credit card companies or anything, like high street lenders, whatever, payday loans, wouldn't get away with doing that.
Yeah.
It's scandalous. But also, you've also signed up for, say, 4 albums. It's like, okay, right, that's recouped for us now. Sign you up again. Here's like 150 grand advance. Okay, brilliant, more money. But now you've got to generate 750 grand to pay that off, and then on it goes. So it's like to recoup and actually get at your deal is like almost impossible unless you're like a massive success. Now,
where does that other 80% go to the label? Yeah, but what are they doing with it?
Shareholders.
Yeah.
Like they'll like put some money into like paying for like video budgets, but also every deal is different. So it could be like you want to see what, like in the small print, what's recoupable, what's not. Maybe they'll cover all your video costs. Or like, oh no, or it's not. Then it's like they sort of trick you into like, we'll fly you to LA, bring all your family, bring the band, be there for 5 days, do this amazing video shoot, blah 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 blah. But not realizing it's actually going on your tab. So, which you're then paying off 5 times over, not just once. So that's how artists can get like just completely swallowed up and buried in it.
And so, how negotiable is that deal in the first place?
Well, it's kind of like, how bad do you want it? It's like, well, here's your shot at stardom.
But is there a case that are you saying that the people who have signed 80-20 deals weren't aware of that and could have negotiated a 60-40, or is it just like,
well, no, labels don't give it to you?
Yeah, that's okay.
Well, right. Or it depends how in demand you are,
right?
So there's obviously not giving away business secrets, but there's like a couple of very well-known bands that you and I know did a distribution deal rather than a record deal. So it's like 80-20 in their favor, but because they were so popular and everyone's kicking their door down, like labels just want something or some part of it. So then they then retain complete creative control as well. Like not all major deals are bad, but I run an independent label and we're doing a lot more damage at the minute for our artists a lot quicker. They're getting paid quicker. And we're like not putting them into these horrible deals where they're like tied down forever.
Quick pause before we get back into it. This episode is brought to you by Frangipani, who produce shirts for the likes of Roger Taylor from Queen, Mick Jagger, Carl Cox, and Fatboy Slim. If you're bored of the safe, samey shirts, Frangipani do things differently. Bold colours, standout prints, and proper personality, all made in limited runs, so that you're not wearing what everyone else is. They've been doing this since 2010, have built a real cult following, and these are shirts for gigs, holidays, weddings abroad, big nights out, or just days you want to get, you know, dressed up in something nice. And if you ever fancy one, there's a nice little bonus for Stage Left listeners. So 25% off everything, even sale items. So just use the code Stage Left at checkout at frangipani-style.com to be able to get 25% off everything, even the sale items. Right, let's get back to the episode.
What advice would you give someone in this room if they're a brilliant artist, and there'll be great songwriters in here and drummers and musicians who are just completely blind to the idea of the kind of legal element of things, but also at the same time are like, this might be my opportunity. What advice would you give in that situation so that you kind of live your values of kind of doing the thing you want to and taking the risk and going for it and not missing that opportunity, but not accidentally signing your life away?
That's a very long-winded answer potentially, but
it's fine.
Ultimately, it boils down to how much you want to give away and how much you want to retain control of. So I'd even say if you can afford to take less money and give less away, because obviously they're like if you're skint, I understand it, we've been there, like absolutely flat broke, all of a sudden here's a six-figure sum, everyone's like, oh, that could sustain all of us for like the next 18 months and get us on tour, brilliant. But then when that runs out, it's not as if there's more royalties coming in, unless you've done really well and recouped it, which luckily we did. But not everyone does that. It's a balance. Like if you, everyone is making money from music, it's all about ownership. If you can retain as much control as possible and ownership, so for instance, again, I won't name names, but like a band of like good mates of ours, like a very well-known big indie band, they were on a major deal, they're now on an indie deal with Cobalt on a 70-30 deal in their favor, and they're like streaming less, but they're making way more money than they ever did.
Interesting.
And living much more comfortably. So everyone just sees like the numbers on Spotify and everyone, like all the monthlies, like, oh, they must be making so much money. Well, if you can generate like enough on a fairer deal, that's fine. Also, we're on a we're now in a world where when my band was coming up, if you sold CDs, you would sell tickets. It was just always went hand in hand. Now there's people that can stream like crazy and can't sell 100 tickets in London, or vice versa, can like pack out whatever, like Kentish Town Forum, and can't stream like over a million on any of their songs. Yeah. So like it's really sort of decoupled now, which is quite interesting. I don't know what it means, but you can make a living without selling your life away, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Great, great advice. We're going to open it up to the room in a moment. So if you've got any questions, just and don't be scared to ask questions, by the way.
Yeah. You know? So please. It always happens when I do this. Everyone's super quiet. And then as soon as we finish, we get jumped on and everyone asks really good questions. It's like, it could benefit everyone.
Yeah, so it could benefit. So we'll come to you in a second. Kind of tell us a bit about the writing and production that you do and kind of what's next for you. You know, because there's some quite exciting things in the pipeline from both sides of
things. Yeah, God. So yeah, I've been doing writing sessions and co-production stuff for like the last 5 years with a bunch of other people. Very long-winded story short. Me and my friend Matt Wills, who was an artist, opened up for us in 2017 on our Eastern European Russian tour. No one's doing them anymore. He came up with us then, sort of knew him, fell out of touch. COVID came, no one's going anywhere. Reconnected because I was doing drum sessions from home, people recording. He's like, do you want to come and do a writing session when we're allowed? So we did that, became best mates, and we've written and produced 150 songs together at that time. He's become an absolute beast of a producer and a writer. I've been sort of working with him. We found and developed Charlotte Plank. Then, if you've heard of her, people like that, got her signed. I've done that with a couple other artists. But that's all just come from, it's kind of like a volume game. You just got to do 100 of those and like maybe 7 or 8 payoff like sessions. I would say to everyone here, just go and do as many writing sessions with as many people as you can. You will also like, I've learned and stolen so many ideas and like techniques from other people. New, experienced, whatever, old, young, like you just get so many little tidbits that you can sort of add to your kind of overall like persona, I guess, writing wise or producing wise. It's the most fun thing you can do. You turn up in the morning, bunch of strangers, you leave, like, sorry, you basically do like speed therapy for an hour with the artist. So it was like, was your boyfriend a prick? Like, like, who do you hate? Okay, that's good. We'll work with that. Write about it, and then you've got this new thing you've made at the end of the day that you're really proud of. It's just like a really fun, creative way to spend the day.
Amazing.
Doing that quite a bit. Obviously got the label, DJ occasionally as well.
Yeah.
Just busy boy.
And other projects next year?
Yes, there's one which you know about. I can't say who. It's going to be fun when it comes out. So a few mates from bands over the years who they've now got a new side project. I'm going to be touring and playing drums on that. It's going to be a stag do in a splitter van, and I can't wait. That'll be new music coming soon. I'll go away to record some of that next week.
Arena level supergroup is what we're talking about there, but we can't name yet, but you'll find out about it very soon. Okay, let's open up to the room. So just a show of hands, anyone any questions for Woody about the music?
Everyone's
industry?
Gone quiet. Yeah, there we go. Someone's brave.
When it comes to those songwriting tips that you say you've gathered from various people you've worked with, are there any which stand out in particular that you've found hugely applicable?
Yes. So a few that are, like, apply across all genres. It's almost like best practice even. So like for one, I've also helped us that I'm in a band with, I think, one of the best songwriters in the country. So I've been learning off Dan quite a bit. He's relentless. He's like, if he's got a song with 3 verses in it, you can bet he's written like 7 or 8 verses and pick the best bits or like Frankenstein parts of it. He's like, his thing is like, you can always write a better song. You can always improve it. Like, so just don't get married to the first thing you do. Like, demoitis is terrible. Everyone gets it. Where it's like, no, this is a song. It's like, you can always better it. Light and shade. I just think about just, you've also almost got to treat the listener like they need to be like bullied almost. Like, here is the verse, here is the chorus, and this needs to be like undeniable. So whether that's like the part of the voice you go to or the melody, how it changes. What else? You can differentiate each section. This is something I try and do, where the downbeat of a melody should change for each section. So say if the verse starts on beat 1, the rest of the song shouldn't. So like the chorus can start on like the and of 2 or whatever. So it's just, it also forces you to think differently in terms of how your melodies flow and the placement. And yeah, that's always been quite a good one. What else? Consistency, like give the listener a chance to actually memorize it. Like, don't have a melody that just changes constantly. Like, repetition's not a bad thing. So you can think about structure like AABB or ABBA or whatever. It's just the basics, really, but they're the basics for a reason, and they really work. So yeah, do that.
Thank you. That's awesome. Right. Any other questions? Any hands? Any drummers? Yeah, let's go with you in the blue hoodie. Thank you.
Hey, yeah, actually, I'm not the drummer, but more like about that. Sorry?
Yes, you are.
No. yeah, so what was the first song what you ever played on your first rehearsal with Bastille?
Sorry, on the first gig, sorry?
Or no, on the first rehearsal, when you ever rehearsed together.
Oh.
First time, if you remember.
So I played with Dan before Bastille for 2 years. We had this chat the other day. I think the oldest Bastille song is one called Daniel in the Den, which is off the first album. That was kind of in the transition period between Dan being solo and then like us lot becoming a band and bringing in Will and Kyle. So that would have been... I remember him playing that to me in his mum's kitchen, I want to say 2009.
Wow.
Yeah, because I'm old as sin.
When was the last time you played that song?
Well, we did a first album anniversary tour like 2 years ago.
Nice.
So that would have been then. But yeah, that involved a lot of... this is really bad to say. I had to go on YouTube at one point to see how I used to play it because I was confronted with my old setup. I was like, I know these sounds are here for a reason on the electronics, but I don't know why or which way around I was doing it. So I had to just kind of go back and watch. I was like, oh, that's what I was doing.
Thank goodness for YouTube.
Yeah, right.
Thank you. Any other questions?
At the back, two at the back.
And then we'll go over there, yeah.
How do you reduce and recover from the physical toll and fatigue of touring?
Good question.
So a few things on touring. So I'm very fortunate that I live in a rarefied atmosphere where I've got a tour manager and a tour bus and catering, and we are little pop stars, little pop tart princesses, basically. In the early days, when you're in the splitter van, getting 4 hours sleep, sharing a room in a travel lodge, someone snoring, all that sort of thing. Like, sleep is a big thing, especially for vocalists and singers. Like, sleep is everything. We accidentally gave ourselves cabin fever on the first US tour because it was like in the middle of winter up in like the northern part of the US where it's proper cold. So you basically went sort of like tour bus, dressing room, stage, repeat. We didn't go outside for maybe 10 days by accident, and I'd be getting proper snappy, fighting with each other. And our tour manager, Erica, was like, would you just please fuck off outside? And then it was like, oh yeah, fresh air and daylight and that sort of thing. So I would suggest just getting outside for an hour just to get a sense of where you are, because it can be, you're just traveling constantly, you've got no real grounding or, like, you know, references where you are. So just go and see something. It could be a statue, a museum, a landmark, whatever. Just get an idea of where you are. That helps. And depending on your instrument as well, I guess, like, just basic things like stretching, drink more water than you realize that you need, because everyone gets dehydrated because they're having too many beers or whatever, or just air con will dry you out, all those sorts of things. If you're thirsty, you're already dehydrated.
Yeah.
What else? Try not to eat too much crap. It's tempting. Or often you don't actually have the choice. It's often eat crap or starve.
Mm.
If you're like eating at service stations or whatever. But yeah, just try and give yourself as much of a break as possible. And like, personal space can be quite lacking, especially on like sort of smaller tours where you're again like sharing hotel rooms. It's just, if you have someone on the tour that you can sort of go to as like your like buddy almost, I guess, that say like if you're having a rough time or whatever, like everyone deals with things differently. It's constant change. And also it's not a normal thing to be up on stage and everyone staring at you and performing every night. It's absolutely fine if that sort of freaks you out a bit.
Yeah, that's great. Great advice. I'm conscious of time. We've got two more questions at the back. So we've got the person in the red hoodie here, and then we'll go to the back there. Thank you. Great question.
What's, like, when you songwriting as a drummer, what's your usual approach? Like, are you trying to, like, when you think of, like, Ringo's playing, he's, like, always serving the song, but sometimes not all songs need, like, just straightforward, this is the part. Like, what do you usually go through, and do you have like influences usually? Do you go and listen to something?
Often, so like I do co-writes nearly like exclusively. Like I very rarely write on my own. I work better with other people. That's just me. As you say, like serving the song is a big thing. Like it sounds really bad in songwriting sessions. It's just quicker. Like I'm quite a quick producer. Like I can program stuff. It's just easier to go and splice and just program a quick loop. It's like better to get the bare bones of the song finished than have like the full production in the day. Because it's obviously to get everyone together, get everyone in that same mindset. I mean, I don't necessarily fully agree with it, but like Freddie Mercury would apparently say, when you start a song, you finish it that day, or it's you just won't be in that mindset ever again. So it's better to have, like, say for instance, you would try and get a rough feel. It's like, is it a sad song? Is it upbeat? Is it jumpy? Is it whatever? Just have something that will serve that purpose that can inform your kind of writing around that. And then go away for 2 or 3 days, come back to it fresh. You can be like, oh, this is great, or this is complete toilet. And then work backwards from there in terms of finishing it and producing it. What was the other tip I heard? When producing stuff as well, if you mute everything except the vocal and the drums, like, does the song still make sense in terms of dynamics up and down? Because if not, then you probably need to tear out the production and start again.
Nice.
Obviously, that's not a hard and fast rule, but that's been quite a useful guide in terms of pulling things together. Because then if you think about like most modern productions, like people are listening like at their iPhones or whatever, it's quite sparse. There's often like say 2 or 3 key things happening at any one time. And there'll often be like one sort of constant thread going through the song, whether it's a drum sound or a certain guitar line or a hook or whatever. There's like something that kind of keeps you in that world the whole 3 or 4 minutes that the song's going.
Great. Thank you. Great question. Thank you. And finally, at the back.
Hi. I think every drummer has like a kind of problem that they would really like to fix. like, for example, my right hand is not as fast as my left hand. And when I'm trying to do doubles, there's like a little bit of tension and it just kind of falls apart after about a minute of doing it. What would you say is your like favorite foundational approach to practicing to try and fix issues like that?
Slow it down and do it a lot and build it up slowly.
Pardon me.
Yeah.
What would you say is your like go-to foundational approach to like fixing little issues like your right hand not being as fast or like your favorite kind of practicing?
So
habits.
I sort of, the sort of practicing habit I'd recommend for everyone, regardless of instrument, would be treat it like sort of sets at the gym almost. So like click tracks are boring, but they're really useful. So I often use like any song that's got programmed drums on it, be it hip hop, pop, whatever. I've got a playlist at different tempos. So it's like, can you play this exercise at this tempo for the whole song? That's way less, well, A, it's less boring, and B, you're actually playing it with music. With the Bob stuff, there'd be bits where I would do it 5 times for like 2 minutes, essentially. When it was perfect, then I'll go up 10 BPM, no more, and do it again. You just gradually step your way up, because again, I keep saying like my muscle memory and that sort of stuff. There's things now where like if I'm playing it really quickly, it's just there now because I practiced it. But if I think about it too much, it almost falls apart. Like it's happened before where like I'm on stage playing a certain song, like These Streets from the first album is quite complicated. Like we've got 4 limbs doing different things at the same time. It's fine, it's in there, but sometimes your brain wanders. And you're like, isn't it mad how like my 4 limbs are doing everything differently? Then it's like, oh god, I'm thinking about it, oh god, and they're just clinging on. You can sort of think yourself out of it a little bit, but yeah, just like, as I said earlier, like me going to see Pat, just have someone else look at it as well, rather than just do it by yourself. Just get an outside opinion.
Yeah, he is the greatest.
He's the boy. Yeah, but I promise you, it's just patience and stuff. I was doing 4 or 5 hours a day for, well, the entire time I was seeing Bob, 4 or 5 years. It's just no shortcut for hard work.
And you owned the kit at that time, like you had your own practice set space.
Yes, well I had a little mini jazz like hip gig kit in my bedroom in my shared house in London, and my neighbours fucking hated me.
But made it in the end, right? So
they still hate me.
Listen, we have to wrap it up there. Thank you so much for your wisdom, your insights, sharing the what it's really like being a touring musician before, during and after tours. Good luck with the new projects in the new year. Thanks for all your great questions.
One last bit of advice. Sorry, for everyone.
Go for it.
One, it is not hard to be nice. Don't be a dickhead, ever. Because this industry is tiny. It can take you 10 years to build a reputation, 10 seconds to torch it. Don't be a dickhead. And two, it boils down to how bad you want it. So there's people like we didn't get signed till quite late. Like, well, I was like 26 in the end when we got signed. There's people we came up with, other bands who were brilliant, better than us, but gave in too early. Some are now estate agents doing whatever. Mm. It boils down to like what are you doing this for? Is it for the love and do you enjoy it, or is it just for success and like how bad do you want to make and play art, essentially? That's it. Sorry.
Amazing advice. Give it up, please, for Woody from Bastille. Cheers. Thanks so much. Cheers. So before you go, a quick thank you to Frangipani for supporting this episode of Stage Left. They're one of the brands that really gets it. Independent, creative, and all about having fun with what you wear. No mass production, no boring designs, just limited edition shirts with character. If you like clothes that feel a bit special, whether that's for festivals or holidays or nights that might get out of hand, Frangipani's worth a look. And don't forget, you can get 25% off everything with the code Stage Left. That's Stage Left, capital letters, including their January sale. So head to Frangipani -style.com. That's Frangipani-style.com. Use the code and treat yourself. Life's too short to be ordinary. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.